tuned into Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal. It is Wednesday, the 5th of May. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Thank you for being with us. We'll be with you until 11:30 this morning on People Powered Radio at 90.3 FM. Today on the broadcast, I'm going to be featuring an interview that I did with longtime community organizer Tim McCaskill in Toronto. The interview, I think, addresses a really important question about the role that community activists within the LGBTQ communities, but also beyond that, play in shaping urgent public health issues and also critiques of systemic social injustice, and bringing those issues forward in ways that often takes the state apparatus a long time to catch up to put it lightly. This is an interview about the dangers of crystal meth within the gay community in Toronto, particularly within the baths. Tim wrote an article about this for Now in Toronto that I thought really addressed the urgency of the issue, but also addressed thinking critically about prevention and drug use and the complexities of navigating those questions and those urgent issues as a longtime community organizer. So I recorded this exchange with Tim for Free City Radio. So here's our conversation.
So I'll just read like a short line from this text that you read, this text that you wrote in Now Toronto. You wrote at the end of this article, another thing I hear is that crystal gives people's lives meaning, a sense of connection, community, blocks out trauma, etc. That's even more reason for a clear, unambiguous message that if you're dealing with loneliness or trauma or feel bad about yourself, in the long run, crystal is just going to make it worse. What we can't afford to do is to continue the silence. Silence equals death. And of course, that is a reference to ACT UP and the history of struggle around the HIV/AIDS crisis. Could you expand on what you wrote and why it was important for you to write that? Because I know that it wasn't an easy thing to put out there, and there's been a lot of debate about what you were trying to articulate and the care that you were trying to express.
Yeah, sure. It was a controversial article, and it got a lot of uptake and repostings and comments, and so it, in a certain way, sparked the kind of conversation that I actually was interested in sparking. Mm-hmm. I had come to a conclusion from my own experience. As I mentioned before, I kind of tend to get most of my recreational sex in baths, despite my advanced age. Mm-hmm. That the harm reduction model that is being applied, certainly here in Toronto, is simply not adequate to dealing with the sexualized use of crystal meth among gay men, right? And that's not to say that harm reduction approaches are not appropriate at particular places and times for particular kind of people, but that as a way of responding to what seems to be a crisis, I just didn't think that it wasn't dealing with it properly.
Okay.
Let me give you a bit of background about how I came to that conclusion. Like, I'm a child of the 60s, right? I grew up with drugs, right? Who doesn't like to get stoned? As I say, gay man who gets recreational sex in the baths. I've enjoyed that space for years. And like probably most people, I've heightened that experience with different kinds of drugs as they came and went out of fashion over the years. And am quite aware that drugs come with some risks. And in my experience, most people can handle those risks most of the time. But what I've seen is that that is simply not true of crystal meth. I guess it was about 15 years ago, maybe, I started getting in the baths this question, like, are you partying, dude? Right? And at first I didn't know what was going on. I only knew that if I kind of looked confused and sort of said, what? Then people would just drift away. And so it was clear that they weren't coming on to me, but they were looking for something else. I figured it out after a while that what they were looking for was crystal. It was about the time, so we're talking about the early 2000s, that Jay Corican, who was an old member of ACT UP New York, did a movie called Rock Bottom. I don't know if you've seen that.
No.
And it was about the impact that crystal meth was having on this kind of friends and family that he had fought with in terms of ACT UP for so many years, right? So another AIDS crisis was over, and all of these people were like in real serious, not all, serious trouble with crystal meth. And
some people in that social network.
In that social network, right?
I'm so sorry. Can you quickly just tell us what is ACT UP for people who might not
know? Okay, sure. ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, was the kind of the first AIDS activist group that started in New York in 1987 and spread, or different groups spread across the U.S. In Toronto, we had AIDS Action Now. Was kind of a parallel, shorter lived. In Montreal, it was Action Sida, that was around in 89 when the International AIDS Conference was held in Montreal in 89. So the people that Corican was filming were seasoned activists, people who had like given a decade of their lives in this fight to get treatments for people with AIDS and to fight the AIDS crisis. And so to see what was happening to them was really quite shocking to many of them. It was about the same time that Peter Staley, who was also a kind of a central figure in ACT UP, did a campaign around meth in New York in the West Village, I think, basically saying, you know, buy meth, get HIV for free. That was the slogan on his poster, right? Which produced this conversation. And then it seemed to decline. I started stopping seeing it so much in the bars. And so, you know, didn't think that much more about it. Like drugs sort of come and go. And I thought maybe this one thankfully has gone. But then a second wave started and it began to hit me closer to home. A couple of friends of mine started really going downhill. It was clear that they were in trouble. And so I started, started doing a bit more research and also asking guys that I was tricking with, like, do you know about crystal meth? Like, what is this stuff, right? To see where a broader group of people were at. And there were, you know, different kinds of answers. Some people were like completely naive. No, I don't know about it. No, never heard of it really. And then one thing I'll never forget, one night I had sex with this guy. And so I asked him about this and he kind of looked at me. There was this kind of pause and he started to cry. And he said, I had some before I came. I can't have sex with it anymore. And I can't feel anything anymore. And he just kept repeating, I can't feel anything anymore. And I was like, Jesus, right? This is like what I, you know, I like to have conversations with people, but this is like really, it was heavy stuff, right?
Heavy. Super heavy, yeah.
Super heavy. Another occasion, I went in on a Friday night, met this guy, and he, you know, we were playing around, and he said, you know, do you want to smoke and stuff? And by this point, I was thinking, like, no, I don't think so, right?
Yeah.
And so I said no, and he went on and smoked, and Anyway, I must have been feeling slutty that weekend because I came back Sunday night, right? This guy, by the way, he was training to be a massage therapist, so he had, you know, he was working 9 to 5, going into work.
Sure.
I came in on Sunday night, and he was still there.
Wow.
He was still stoned. He'd been there like all day, Friday night, all day Saturday, all day Sunday. And this was Sunday evening.
Okay.
And it doesn't take a rocket scientist to realize he's not going to be able to get to work tomorrow morning, right? At 9 o'clock, right? You can see his life beginning to unravel. And I think maybe the worst, I got a call from a friend who I'd known for years and years and years, who I'd known had been using. You know, I'd meet sort of every now and then, and he was calling me from a psych ward, and he'd attacked somebody, right? And he didn't know why he'd attacked them, but he'd like seriously injured somebody, and he'd been in jail, and now he's in the psych ward, and he was hearing voices, and, you know, could I bring him in some food? So I went to visit him in the psych ward with some, you know, noodles, and I said, you know, man, you've got to stop doing meth, right? Look what's happening to you. And he said, oh, no, it's not meth. I don't know why this is happening, but it can't be meth because I'm doing harm reduction.
Okay.
And I thought, like, oh, fuck, right?
Wow.
So,
Well, that Tim, that sort of goes to one of the key points I was hoping to hear from you about mm-hmm. today, which is sort of discussions about approaches to harm reduction. And and I really appreciated you sharing that article and all the personal context and emotion of those experiences that you've described really, I think, gives a lot of body to some of the ideas that you expressed in the Now article, obviously. So I'm just wondering if you could share a bit about sort of the where you're coming from on that point and what you'd like to try to put out there in terms of frameworks of harm reduction and thinking critically about that.
Yeah. It doesn't seem to me that there's anything in terms of harm reduction that precludes doing education, warning people about a dangerous drug, and doing everything you can to try to convince them that this is not a good place to go, right? I mean, and you can see that in terms of harm reduction programs. If there's a bad batch of whatever out there, mm-hmm. the harm reduction people are the ones that say there's a really bad batch out there. It's too strong. It's mixed. It's sure. not. It's like, you know, beware, right? They do that kind of stuff. But when I suggest doing this on a kind of a regular community basis, right, for a drug which is in itself quite dangerous, mm-hmm. then people freak out because they're saying this is stigmatizing people that that use drugs. And I think that there's a real difference between stigmatizing people who use drugs and saying that a drug is dangerous, right? That there's a real difference there, right? They say, well, you know, if you say that this drug is dangerous, then, you know, you're intimating that the people who are using it are kind of sleazy and low life and all of this kind of stuff. You're stigmatizing them. And it's like, you know, really the opposite. You know, if I felt that people were just like, you know, not worthy of life, then why would I be bothered about it, right? I'm interested in this because I can see what's happening to people, right? And I can see what's happening to kind of younger people and newer people to the community, whether like Toronto is like this big immigrant center, right? So we've got lots of people who are coming here who are experiencing gay life for the first time, and they have no idea about what this stuff is.
Yeah.
And if they go into environments where this is normalized, then, you know, they're going to use it, and they're extremely vulnerable to getting into trouble.
Wow.
There's a project that just was published last November, I believe it was. It's called the Crystal Meth Project, and it's based at a research center, the community-based research center in British Columbia.
Okay.
And if you look at it's completely from a harm reduction perspective, but if you actually look at the figures, like, it looks like about half the people that use Crystal get into trouble, right? Like a doctor friend of mine said, you know, you're using Crystal is like flipping a coin with your life, right? Wow. This is like, is this, you know, some people have a really bad reaction to weed, right?
Sure. Yeah.
If they have a bad reaction to weed, then they don't do it anymore, right? Mm-hmm. But it's really hard to get off meth if you have been using it regularly, right? Or if you've been using it for a while, it's like really, really difficult because it's, you know, it's screwed up your dopamine system. It's like you've associated sexual pleasure with it. It becomes like a really difficult thing to stop doing. Sure. And so it seems to me that the first line of harm reduction is to stop people from getting into a situation that is harmful, right? Warning them that like this is something that needs to be avoided. Treatment programs for people that are using, right? But like, we're far better off if people had, you know, we're able to make the kind of connections that they need to kind of make without getting themselves involved in this drug.
I got it. I really get the sense of what you're saying. And you know, in regards to the way that there is such an important critique of criminalization, right? Like in general, right? Like we're talking about Crystal, but in general, in terms of fighting back against the frameworks that criminalize and minimize the humanity of people using, right? And so I can see the sort of pendulum of argument, right? Like if we're thinking about sort of the pushback from the community-based level of saying, well, actually, we are trying to defend people's, their dignity and rights. I mean, you know, just in the sense of like, I can see where that, obviously where that argument's coming from, but it's always interesting from the activist point of view to sort of see sometimes how there's like almost, it can be like an overcompensation in responding to like the injustice of the discourses of power. And I'm sort of seeing that described in the debates that you're having around this issue. I don't know if that speaks to you at all.
Yeah, no, I think it certainly does. I mean, the criminalization, the legal criminal regime for dealing with substance use has been an utter failure, and it's racist, and it's, you know, anti-poor people, and it produces this industrial, carceral organization that is gobbling up huge resources and doesn't do any good to anybody. So yes, absolutely. Nobody should be criminalized for having small amounts of substances of whatever kind, right? You can see in Portugal, for example, which is kind of the poster boy for this, they decriminalized drugs of all kinds. Didn't mean they stopped policing them. People would not be sent into court, though. They'd be sent into kind of programs where people would try to make sure that they had a place to live, that the kind of the social influences on their life put them in a place that they could get over it. They were offered treatment programs. They were employment was found for them. And they did huge education throughout society about the dangers of getting involved in this kind of drug use.
Sure.
And that was really successful. Like overdoses plummeted, like people who were addicted plummeted, all of those kinds of things. The harm reduction way of approaching this, I think, is one that has been developed in a struggle with this criminal regime, right?
Yes.
Criminalization regime, right? And remember, harm reduction began connected with the AIDS epidemic in terms of people who were IV drug users, giving them clean needles so they wouldn't share needles and spread HIV, right? Yes. I mean, that's how it started. And the people who were doing that were threatened with being arrested themselves because they were contributing to crime. So you can see where that harm reduction has been shaped by this struggle with this criminalization system, right?
Yes.
But that shaping, I think, has not always been particularly useful, right? In terms of this kind of situation. One aspect of it is that the way that harm reduction has developed since then is largely around the opioid epidemic.
Yeah.
The opioid epidemic is very different. Opioids are depressants. Crystal meth is a stimulant, right? They're very different. They affect people in different ways, right? So for example, if somebody is on opioids, if you give them a regular clean supply, whether it's a substitution or real heroin or whatever, right? Mm-hmm. And make sure that they've got a place to live, they can get on with their lives, right? That's not true of crystal meth. If you start doing crystal meth on a regular basis, right, you get into real trouble, no matter how clean the drug is, right? So what I worry about sometimes is that the kinds of practices that have been developed around an opioid epidemic have been like picked up and transported into gay men's sexualized youth of crystal meth, and you expect them to work again, and they don't work in the same way. It's a different kind of drug. So we can't do that kind of thing.
Got it.
The other thing that I think that the harm reduction has been shaped by the struggle with the criminalization regime is in terms of its conceptual categories, mm-hmm. right? You always hear when I think it's in the article that responded to mine, where I was talking about the dangers of crystal meth, and they say 80% of people who use drugs have no problem with it. Okay, but I'm not talking about drugs. You know, we're not talking about weed or aspirin or drugs, right? We're talking about crystal meth. And it's not true that 80% of the people that use crystal meth have no trouble with them. Mm-hmm. So the harm reduction movement has, in a certain way, adopted the framework of the criminalization movement and the war on drugs, right? So you don't talk about specific drugs. You don't talk about specific substances and how dangerous they are or how benign they are. But drugs become this category. In the war on drugs, it was, well, we know that marijuana doesn't get you addicted, but it's a gateway drug, right? Therefore, it has to be treated in the same way. It mm-hmm. still has to be criminalized. And so what you see is from that kind of notion, umbrella term of drugs as a bad thing in the criminalization regime, you get the kind of positive image approach in harm reduction mm-hmm. so that mm-hmm. there's no such thing as a bad drug, right? Mm-hmm. It's just how they're used or just how people deal with them. Or, I mean, that's kind of disingenuous, I think, mm-hmm. right? There are drugs that are really strong and have really bad effects, and that we need to disaggregate those kinds of things. We need to say, I'm not talking about drugs, I'm talking about crystal meth, right? And mm-hmm. the response to that is, well, that's a hierarchy. You're creating a hierarchy of drugs. Well, sorry, there is a hierarchy of drugs. Mm-hmm. Some drugs are more dangerous than others and need to be dealt with in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Building on what you're saying, and maybe we could finish on this point, Tim, was, you know, just a thought when you were describing sort of the complexities of the community debates around criminalization and also the, you know, the specifics of how to deal with drug use within different contexts. You know, we've been talking about the baths, but generally it really made me think about the ways that public policy is often started at a grassroots level, right? Like mm-hmm. often it takes years to find a way to have policy reflect the, you know, the debates that happen in communities. If we're talking about communities who've experienced systemic marginalization, I mean, we're talking about the gay community today, LGBTQ communities, but I think that points to a broader situation, which is the lack of recognition of the role that activists and community advocates play in actually having these discussions, which are not easy, right? Mm-hmm. To get to a point where there can be some sort of coherence in terms of policy. And the reason I wanted to bring this up was the recognition, you know, you've called yourself an activist dinosaur in our last interview, but I mean, the recognition of the role that the activist process plays. I mean, yeah. We're in this particular context, but also more generally, and I know you've been involved in so many things. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
Yeah, that's kind of
it's a big question. I'm sorry.
A philosophical question there. I think that you're right completely that we haven't seen any change that hasn't been pushed by activists. But the state is also a very tricky creature. And so it can take your demands and turn them into something else. So we started talking about gay liberation.
Yeah.
We ended up with marriage. Right? Wow. Marriage wasn't on our agenda, right? Yeah. But that's what the state ended up giving to us, right? You know, yeah. People want to get married, that's fine. But like, that's not why we started this kind of stuff, right? Mm-hmm. So I think we need to look at these different paradigms in terms of substance use in the same way. I mean, we've had different paradigms, right? There's like we call it the religious moral one. Like mm-hmm. maybe like Alcoholics Anonymous is kind of the poster boy for that, right? Which sees drug use as a sin, a falling away from God, and therefore you've got to get into a group and you've got to connect and, you know, all that kind of stuff. The criminal legal regime, which sees this as a crime, mm-hmm. and therefore what you do is throw people in jail and like teach them a lesson and, you know, ruin their lives and make sure they're going to continue, right? You've got the medical regime, which sees it as a... which sees it as a an illness, right? Which has to be treated. Mm-hmm. Only doctors can do the treating. So then you move into this whole medical apparatus. Mm-hmm. And then there's the harm reduction regime that is kind of emerging, mm-hmm. which I think is kind of, it kind of toggles between two different notions of what's going on. On one hand, you try to, as you say, produce a positive image. And so you see drug use as this kind of rational choice that people have taken. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that needs to be supported and they need to be helped to keep that as safe as possible. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of an idealist rational choice model. Mm-hmm. Or then if you push, when I say like, therefore we need education, then they say, well, no, it's like the social determinants of health. Somebody actually said to me is, you know, as long as there's racism and sexism and homophobia and poverty, people are going to use drugs. right? So that's kind of a vulgar materialist notion, on the other hand, right? That, like, nothing we can do about this except, like, hold people's hands and try to help them not burn their lips when they're smoking on a hot pipe. And I remember when he said that, I thought, you know, in the old days we used to say no justice, no peace. And now it's like no justice, more drugs, right? I mean, where does that get us, right? I think there's a problem there. So we can see harm reduction. Some practices are being absorbed by the state apparatuses. Like, you look at the ASOs, you look at a lot of public health stuff, they all talk harm reduction now, right? And I think to myself, okay, but is setting up a tent for people to consume safely all we want, right? Because on the one hand, what's happening is that a disposable population from the point of view of the state is being kept out of the medical system, right? I mean, if you look at the funding applications for a lot of these programs, say their success is measured by the way that it keeps people out of emergency rooms, you know, for the proper people to be in emergency rooms. But you don't want this, we don't want this population to be there mucking up our hospital system.
Wow.
Right? And so in a certain way, moving people to a poorly, you know, to a tent in a field where, you know, a public health nurse makes sure that they don't overdose. I mean, that's certainly better than doing it, you know, in a back alley where people do.
Sure, overdose. Of course.
On the other hand, you know, you can see neoliberal rationalization going on here. A population that nobody cares about, who, you know, are not productive anymore, right? Being sent off to this kind of second tier and kept out of a proper medical system.
Wow.
So, there's all sorts of stuff that we need to begin to think about and talk about here. So I am glad to open that conversation, but I mean, the bottom line for me in terms of the community that I'm involved in is that we need, like, targeted, sex-positive, consistent education in various languages to people who are coming into this community to let them know that this is something that they need to avoid, because you can get into real, real trouble. Like, half the people that use it seem to get in some sort of trouble. And, you know, given everything else that's going on in society, that's not something that we need.
Tim McCaskill, thank you so much for talking with me today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
That was a conversation with longtime community organizer within the gay LGBTQ communities in Toronto, Tim McCaskill. Thank you, Tim, so much for being on Free City Radio. It is Wednesday, the 5th of May. I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. We broadcast every Wednesday at 11 a.m. on CKUT. Do stay tuned. We also have a podcast. You can search for Free City Radio on Apple Podcasts. And do stay tuned. The XX Files is coming up next. And to finish the show, I'm going to go out with a bit of music from an awesome artist in Vancouver called Secret Pyramid.
great grandmaster Melly Mel.
And this is Scorpio, show no shame.
And I'm Dynamite, the hypest man in the business.
And if you got ears, listen to 90.3 CKUT.
In solidarity with the Wet'suwet'en, a community event taking place on Wednesday, May 12th from 6:30 till 8 p.m. This event will be focused on the call from many Indigenous, climate justice, and student activist groups calling on McGill University to divest from TC Energy, the company that is constructing the Coastal GasLink pipeline on Wet'suwet'en lands without the collective support of the Indigenous nation. This event is supported by Divest McGill, McGill Nurses for Planetary Health, the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, the Indigenous Student Alliance, and is co-organized with Wet'suwet'en climate justice activist Marlene Hale. Join us on Wednesday, May 12th from 6:30 till 8 p.m. Visit divestmcgill.com. This event is a CKUT Radio co-presentation.
The XXX Files. Exploring feminism and technology through space and time.
Good morning. You are listening to the XX Files on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is Wednesday, January 24th,